I'm Frank Stacio. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. Those are loyalists to Shiite Muslim cleric Muqtada al-Sadr in Iraq. There are some reports that indicate Sadr's militia members removed their weapons from the holy Imam Ali shrine in Najaf, possibly ending an intense two-week-old showdown between loyalists and U.S.-led Iraqi forces. Militants were using the shrine as a hideout. Now, apparently, they've given control to Iraq's highest Shiite cleric, Grand Ayatollah Hussein al-Sistani. The situation is still in flux. Earlier today, as events were unfolding in Najaf, we spoke with Carl Vick, a reporter for The Washington Post.
What I know at this hour is that defensive combat operations by the American military have been ordered to basically halt because they don't really know what's going on the ground. Sometime this afternoon, the Najaf chief of police and his rapid reaction force head were here at the base and said they were moving from here to the shrine, that they had prepared to take control of it. Whether that in fact happened, we can't confirm. There's some witnesses who say these weapons are out. There's not been a contact with it. There's fighting around the shrine. It's between the Mahdi Army and U.S. force. Not for the shrine, but in the vicinity and preventing anyone from getting closer than 100 yards and approaching and learning who's actually inside it. So that's the situation as I understand it now.
Well, I keep seeing reports that the Mahdi Army is turning over its weapons and that weapons are coming out of the shrine. Have you seen any evidence of that?
The military has not. They don't have anyone with eyes on the place. I suppose they could put up some mud. They haven't done it already, put up some drones or scopes or something, but that's not clear.
As late as yesterday, we were hearing that the Iraqis were prepared to storm the shrine, and it looked like the standoff was going to have to end violently. Has this announcement today come as a surprise?
The thinking here is that last night was the heaviest night of bombardment and combat that's been heard here in these 2 weeks. There was heavy fighting in the shrine the first 2 days, but last night there were two AC-130 Spectre gunships, modified 130 cargo planes with artillery, and their nickname is Flying Death, and they were just hammering some Mahdi Army positions near the mosque, not very near it, but it was defensive. They were trying to offer cover for some troops who were under fire from mortars there, but it was thunderous, very frightening sound, and the thinking is maybe this got soldered again. That he was frightened by that and tried to cut a deal, and that's what happened today. Who knows?
Well,
it's all obscure at this point.
Apparently, the thinking was that Sadr didn't believe that the Americans or the Iraqis would risk damage to the shrine because of the fear of the backlash. But apparently, what you're saying is he got the sense that maybe they were prepared to follow through on their threats.
What we've seen here is when he has moved. When he has moved off his position and compromised and made concessions, is following strong verbal threats, ultimatums, coupled with somewhat intimidating military activity close to him. That's the stick with the carrot. The carrot being join the Iraqi political process and be a legitimate leader. That's the thinking.
And, of course, at this point, there's no indication that he's decided to do that, so we could see a repetition of Najaf in some other city at some other point with Sadr.
That's the great fear. They've played this game twice here, a couple times in Baghdad and Sadr City, where he's sort of his base. So the military point of view is we want to erase this threat, this break the back of this militia. If we're not fighting him in the mosque, we'll be fighting him in the city tomorrow. Prime Minister Alawi laid down several conditions. Getting out of the mosque is only one of them.
All right, Carl, thank you very much.
Cheers.
Carl Vick is a reporter for The Washington Post and spoke with us from Najaf, Iraq. As Muqtada al-Sadr has risen to prominence over the last year, rumors have circulated that he's been getting some help from the government in neighboring Iran. And that raises the question, are the United States and Iran, in effect, engaged in a proxy war in Iraq? Earlier, we spoke with Ruel Mark Grecht. He's a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. And I began by asking him, how certain are American officials that the government of Iran is aiding Muqtada al-Sadr?
Well, I think the circumstantial evidence certainly suggests that there has been growing support for Sadr since last August. I think there might be some debate on exactly what, how much support, but that certainly elements of the clerical regime are behind him certainly seems to be true.
What kind of help is he getting?
I think primarily he's getting financial aid. He probably is getting some logistical aid. He may actually also be getting what you might call paramilitary training. If you look at Sadr's forces last August or last October, where he attempted what you might call a premature push, those forces were fairly easily dispersed. They certainly were driven out of Najaf without a great deal of difficulty. Now, quite the contrary, his forces, the Mahdi army, seems much better organized. It seems to know how to deal offensively and defensively, and it certainly suggests that someone's been practicing. Now, some of that support could have come from various ex-Baathist Sunni groups that could have lent assistance, but it also seemed quite reasonable that some of that support would have been coming from a unit like the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps.
Okay, so training and money. Any people?
Probably not a lot. I mean, there are Iranians all over Iraq. You can't help but run into them. Literally, they're in the thousands, tens of thousands, and the Iranian holy cities. I suspect that there are, you know, substantial deployments of intelligence officers and members of the Guard Corps into Iraq, but Sadr certainly doesn't need them for manpower. I mean, he has enough young men in the Iraqi Shiite ghettos to draw off to field the forces that he has in the Mahdi army.
Why are they supporting him and not a cleric like Ayatollah Sistani?
Primarily because Sadr actually does not want to create a functioning democratic Iraq. He wants to have, at least so he says, some type of theocratic system modeled on the Iranian one. Grand Ayatollah Sistani and the traditional clergy of Najaf have said that they want to have some type of a democratic system. They want to back a democratic government. If that were to happen, that's a very bad model for the Iranian clerical regime in Tehran. That's not what they want to see develop in Iraq.
But there are reformists now in the government in Iran.
Well, there certainly are, but they unfortunately, the reformists really don't have much power. And they, when paired against the forces that are behind people like the spiritual, so-called spiritual leader Khamenei and Rafsanjani, the number two in Iran, they really don't have much power at all.
So they really aren't the folks sending who have their finger on the triggers or on the.
No, they don't. They don't really control the security or intelligence apparatus.
Is there any sort of grander maneuvering going on? Obviously, the regional, you know, you talked about what the Iranians have at stake in terms of the kind of government they have next door. But what about the U.S. and Iran? Is there some other game going on here behind the scenes?
Well, in Iraq, no. I mean, there is the larger issue, which is going to, I think, come to the front burners fairly quickly, which is the nuclear weapons issue. That is, the Iranians have had a fairly substantial nuclear research program, which has aimed at developing nuclear weapons since the mid-1980s. It's kicked into high gear since the early 1990s. And as the IAEA inspectors have revealed, it's a fairly advanced program now. I don't see that really becoming a factor in Iraq, but it certainly make the relationship between the United States and Iran that much more difficult.
What's your thought on how the immediate situation will play out? The Iraqis have threatened to send in troops. Will they do that and threaten that holy site?
They may have to. I mean, would that that were not the case. It's not a good idea to go in there, but Sadr is, in fact, he has done enormous damage to the traditional clergy. He's done enormous damage to Grand Ayatollah Sistani by taking his city, by essentially thumbing his nose at them. If we do not have the support of the traditional clergy, I'm very skeptical whether we can, in fact, have a successful democracy born in Iraq. the only way you are going to bring back the traditional clergy is to get that young man out of Najaf and his forces. So he may give up. I'm very doubtful. He has certainly shown no desire to do that. And we'll have to see, but we should not dawdle. I mean, that was the American problem in the Sunni town of Fallujah, where we went back and forth and we got ourselves in a great deal of trouble. If we're going to do this, we need to do it quickly and in great force.
Ruel, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Ruel Mark Grecht is a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He spoke with us from Washington. Just ahead, a director's cut of the cult classic Donnie Darko makes its way to theaters. And later in the show, how the rising cost of health insurance is leading employers to change their hiring practices. There's more to come here and now. Just before the start of the Summer Olympics, we profiled Wolf Weigo, the captain of the U.S. men's water polo team. Today, his team was defeated by the Hungarians. Weigo joins us from Athens. Hello.
Hey, Frank. How's it going?
Good. The team had its first loss to Hungary today in the preliminaries. How does that affect your chances for placing in the Olympics?
We're still looking good. We won our first two games, and we have two games left in the preliminary round. Hungary was the defending Olympic champion and defending world champion, so they're pretty tough, but after the game, they said we gave them their toughest match so far, and it was a hard-fought loss for us.
Yeah, how did you feel about how you played?
The team played really well, and it's a good sign for us that we've had three really good games so far, and no team's better than Hungary. So we're looking forward now. We have Russia tomorrow, and then we also have Serbia 2 days after that.
All right, this is your third Olympics. How does this compare to previous experiences?
You know, the Olympics are pretty similar. The village is, you know, the same. Everything, all the people and the dining hall, you know, pretty similar. So, but it's been a positive experience so far.
A lot more, certainly there's been a lot more reporting on the security in the time after the Iraq War, especially for Americans, and I wonder if you felt the effects of that.
Yeah, there's security everywhere. We feel really safe everywhere you go. All our little training sites that are, you know, sort of out of the Olympic loop. And then the actual facility, it's really secure on all our buses. We have security, and we feel really safe. We don't feel like there's any threat at all. It's just like a normal Olympic Games for us, really.
Well, you don't have guys bobbing around with sunglasses bobbing around the water with you, though.
They're not in the water. They're on the pool deck.
That's good, because those guys in suits with the glasses talking their sleeves, that'd be a funny picture, but I guess it'd get in the way. Well, good luck.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Wolf Weigo is captain of the U.S. men's water polo team. To find out more about him, you can visit our website at here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Here and Now. In the fall of 2001, the sci-fi thriller Donnie Darko made its debut in theaters. It starred Jake Gyllenhaal as a disturbed young man haunted by visions of an evil rabbit.
28 days. 6 hours. 42 minutes. 12 seconds.
Donnie Darko almost immediately died, but through midnight screenings and DVD sales, the movie rose again as a cult favorite, and now Donnie Darko is returning to theaters in a director's cut edition. But will the quirky film catch on this time? Here and Now film reviewer Renee Graham joins us in the studio. Hi, Renee.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. This is a guy with visions of a rabbit, but it ain't Harvey.
No, this is a very evil rabbit. There's nothing benevolent about this rabbit at all. It's a tough film to explain, but essentially, as you mentioned in the opening, Jake Gyllenhaal plays his character Donnie Darko, a high school student, emotionally troubled, hypersensitive young man, who begins having these sort of visitations, these midnight visitations from this really evil rabbit, and then the rabbit begins to tell him things that are going to be happening in the future.
I have to admit, I just saw it for the first time last night, and I love the thing, but I can see how this would really appeal, particularly to high school kids and to kids in their early 20s. Is that the target audience for this?
I think to a certain degree it is, but I also think that it has a greater relevance, all the things that are happening in the world, and there are some really sort of apocalyptic visions in this film. And I think just the general unsettled state of the world, I think it will appeal to people in a different way. What's interesting is that when the film was originally supposed to be released in October of 2001, those apocalyptic visions were really just too much for a lot of people, sort of in that post 9/11 world. And one of the key points in the film is a jet engine sort of mysteriously falling from the sky and crashing through a house. And I just don't think anyone was really going to be able to see that film. So the film, when it was originally released, made less than $500,000 during its initial theatrical run.
But then it really caught on. It was a midnight showings, and it's got a real cult following. Yeah.
Midnight showings, and especially DVD. And it is the kind of film, because it's a very complicated film, a very layered film, that it benefits greatly from DVD. It benefits from repeated watchings. And I could see where people going to see this in a movie theater for the first time might be a little put off and feel like, what am I watching? What's going on? There's this weird rabbit. There's this kid with these visions. What's happening? But I can definitely see where DVD helped it become the cult film that it's become. And I think now with DVD sales, it's actually made $10 million.
Wow. It's quirky and a little bit uneven. I mean, like a lot of sci-fi films, it tries to take on some of the bigger themes. You know, it takes on the meaning of life, God, religion. And then there's a little romantic plot that happens at the same time. So it's got that kind of Hollywood gloss as well.
It has that. But it also has, as you said, those sort of big sci-fi themes. You get, the space-time continuum and vessels and portals and time travel. You know, it all sounds maybe geekier and dorkier than the film actually is. It's really quite an affecting film. And I think even people who may walk out and think, I'm not sure I like that, it's going to stick with you days later, and you're going to keep thinking about things in the film, and you're going to be thinking about your own life in comparison to the film in certain ways, and I think that's what makes the film strong.
Yeah, and I have to say that as interesting as this story was and as sort of un-Hollywood as this kind of story was, I was a little disturbed at times by the fact that there seemed to be this need to have a romantic, that the geeky guy still gets the pretty girl in the story, although I guess they do have an interesting relationship.
They do. I mean, we'll hear in this next clip that his girlfriend is Gretchen, played by Jenna Malone, and the clip we hear is the first time they really kind of connect.
So, why'd you move here?
My parents got a divorce. My mom had to get a restraining order against my stepdad. He has emotional problems.
Oh, I have those too. What kind of emotional problems does your dad have?
He stabbed my mom 4 times in the chest.
I'm watching the film, and this teacher walks into the school, and I'm saying, boy, that looks a lot like Drew Barrymore. It is Drew Barrymore.
There's some interesting... She almost has a cameo role, but she's also one of the executive producers on the film, so she really believed in this project. It was done by a first-time writer-director, Richard Kelly, and she really helped this film go along, and I think it's really... it must be really gratifying to her that the film was having the second life in this director's cut.
And how about the director's cut? You've seen that. Is it for the better?
I'm not sure. I mean, it's fine. I mean, there are certain, some of the special effects are even bigger. In some cases, now the film's made more money, Richard Kelly was able to swap out certain songs for maybe songs he originally wanted but just couldn't afford to get the rights to. And I'm not sure in all cases that works. And, he uses an NNX song, Never Tear Us Apart, which is very well known, but it gives the scene sort of a weird MTV feel as opposed to the original song, which was by Echo and the Bunnymen, which just has a much better and moodier sense to it. But, what's interesting in the film is just... It on one hand, it's like this teen film, and it makes people think of John Hughes, and it takes place in the 80s, which we know because the Dukakis-Bush presidential race is going on. But at the same time, it doesn't sort of, make the adults all seem like idiots. And with the clip we'll hear next, we'll see the scene with Donnie trying to deal with his mother, and his mother being rather upset with the way he's behaving.
Where do you go at night?
You just get out of my room.
Did you toilet paper the Johnson's house?
Is that what you came in here to ask me?
No.
I stopped ruling houses in the sixth grade, Mom.
What happened to my son? I don't recognize this person today.
Then why don't you start taking the goddamn pills?
Drew Barrymore is in the film. There are some other well-known actors in this film.
Yeah, you keep seeing familiar faces pop up. Noah Wiley from ER plays a sympathetic teacher at Donnie's school. And one of the really interesting roles is this character of Jim Cunningham, who's a sort of motivational speaker played to creepy perfection by Patrick Swayze. And I've always found Patrick Swayze kind of vapid and unsettling, and that really works in this character he plays.
And the film really is open to a lot of interpretation.
It is. I mean, people see the politics of the film because the time it's set in, and they sort of look at it, you know, here we are 3 years later, and there's another election with another Bush. People see the apocalyptic visions. But the film has some very serious sort of spiritual and religious undertones and overtones, which you don't really get necessarily until later in the film, and you sort of realize what's going on. And I think that especially is why a lot of teenagers sort of dealing with their own emotional angst can really relate to this character.
Thank you very much, Renee.
Thank you.
Here and now, film reviewer and Boston Globe pop culture columnist Renee Graham. Donnie Darko, the director's cut, playing in selected theaters around the country this summer. Stay with us. There is more ahead, here and now. Through the thick and thin. I'm Frank Stachow. It's Here and Now. Healthcare is a hot topic in this year's presidential election. John Kerry told firefighters in Boston yesterday that soaring medical costs are slowing the nation's economic recovery. Nationwide, health insurance now costs employers about $3,000 per year per worker, and that's leading businesses to change how they hire. Joining us on the line is Ken Thorpe. He's chairman of the Health Policy Department at Emory University. Welcome, Professor.
Well, thank you.
Give us a sense of how rapidly healthcare premiums are rising.
Well, in the private sector, they've been growing at double-digit rates now for the last 5 or 6 years. So you're talking about 10 to 15% for a 5 to 6 year period, at the same time when those same workers' income, their wages, are only rising at 2 to 3%.
Right, and I would have to think that for the employers, that has to be by far the largest cost increase in any part of their costs.
Oh, without question. Health benefits are the fastest growing costs that employers are facing today. And it's one of the major dilemmas that they're facing as they look to hire new workers. The cost of health insurance from a business standpoint has been one of the factors that has really led to the slow growth in jobs. Employers are reluctant to hire workers because if they hire a full-time worker, that health insurance benefit is a very expensive proposition.
What is causing these costs to go up?
One is just simply the march of science and new technology. So we have new medicines and new drugs coming on the market.
I'm going to have to stop you there. I thought that technology was supposed to bring down the cost of all this good stuff.
Well, you'd think that, but actually the technologies that come in place are generally replacing less expensive ways of doing business.
The other thing is that these costs seem to be going up far faster in the United States than any other industrialized country, and yet we don't have the outcomes that they have in other countries. We're getting far less for our buck than any other industrialized country in the world. Why is that?
Well, part of it is how we spend our dollars. We don't spend much money on prevention. You know, our medical care system is very reactive. It's designed to, you know, we wait and sit back until people get sick and they show up. And when they show up, you know, they're very expensive. And we generally do a good job of technologically treating them. You know, other countries are much more proactive. They're out there trying to attack directly the underlying causes of illness. And they, you know, literally nip the problem in the bud. Now,
yeah,
they make investments up front.
Yeah, well, investment up front, but I'm wondering if that isn't simply the economics of the healthcare industry in this country. You don't make money until somebody gets sick.
No, that's right. I mean, you know, we're in a system right now where, you know, when somebody does become very ill and we use a lot of the high-tech procedures, it can potentially be very profitable.
So President Bush says businesses ought to negotiate volume discounts on health insurance. John Kerry wants to reduce premiums by having the government pick up some of the cost of catastrophic coverage. Do you think either of these are workable plans?
Well, I think they're both good ideas. I mean, the issue is the magnitude of you know, how big of a bang for the buck are we going to get here? Senator Kerry's plan is designed to reduce the cost of private health insurance by about 10%. Both the president and Senator Kerry want employers to pool together to negotiate premiums. Their approach to it is slightly different, but certainly pooling is a good idea. You know, I guess the question is whether that's going to be very effective in really driving the growth and spending down.
What is the Ken Thorpe solution?
Well, I think we need to do several things. Certainly, what we pay for healthcare services are too high here, and it starts with prescription drugs. So. You know, I think we need to look very seriously at allowing a government, particularly state governments, perhaps, to band together to negotiate lower prices. Secondly, the cost of how we administer our healthcare system is too high, and we can do a much better job in lowering those costs. You know, things as simple as having medical care claims submitted electronically. You know, we have 40% of our claims still on paper. Those paper claims cost $5 per claim. An electronic claim is about 50 cents per claim. So we're spending too much money on how we administer our healthcare system as well. You know, and third, I think we can do a better job of how we treat patients that are really driving the growth in healthcare spending up, and those are patients with chronic healthcare conditions, heart patients, diabetics. Those patients are only getting 50% of the care that they should be getting. And it's bad quality care that they are getting. You know, that's going to require some basic restructuring of how we deliver healthcare services to those patients. We can get better value, and I think we can get that at lower cost.
Professor Thorpe, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Ken Thorpe is chairman of the Health Policy Department at Emory University. An 8-year-old girl from New Jersey was recently told that her first communion was not valid because the wafer she received during the sacrament contained no wheat. But Haley Waldman's mother, Elizabeth Pelly Waldman, says the little girl can't eat wheat because she suffers from celiac disease, making her gluten intolerant. While Pelly Waldman is pressuring the Trenton Diocese to accept a rice-based communion wafer as a substitute, the diocese is firm in its position that the wafer, like the bread served at the Last Supper, must contain some unleavened wheat. Elizabeth Pelly Waldman joins me on the line from Briel, New Jersey. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Hi.
What did your church say at first when you suggested the rice wafer?
Our original parish could not give Haley the rice wafer. You know, they did, you know, tell us that it is a canon law that there must be some wheat in the host, and they declined to give us the rice wafer. An anonymous parish volunteered to allow Haley to make her first Holy Communion with them in May, and they did give her a rice wafer, and she did make her first Holy Communion on May 2nd.
I'm curious to know if rice wafers are available or if this was just an improvisation that you made sort of on your own.
No, they absolutely are available. I did purchase them from a Seattle-based food manufacturer.
Food, but not necessarily a Catholic supply.
Correct.
Manufacturer. So then the priest in the nearby parish said he didn't mind using the substitute. So who says it's a problem?
Around mid-July, I got word from that priest that Bishop Smith at the Diocese of Trenton said he would not register her sacrament because the host itself was not valid, therefore the sacrament was not valid.
How's Haley taking all of this?
What she said most recently is that it's just not fair, and she wishes she could have her bread again.
She wishes she could have her bread again.
Right, because, a couple of Sundays after that, up until July, we did continue to go to the parish, and Haley and I both, because I have celiac as well, received our rice-based toast weekly.
So you were doing this in the church. The church was allowing it, and you were bringing in your rice-based wafers that they were serving to you each Sunday at Mass.
Correct.
If you could find a church that would do this, would you feel that the First Communion was indeed valid, even if a bishop told you that he wasn't going to validate it?
That's kind of a tricky question, because I think when Haley goes then to make her other sacraments, we're going to run into a problem with the church, because the sacrament of communion, First Holy Communion, has to be filed first. Then she may go on and be confirmed, married in the Catholic Church, and whatever she chooses to do.
Mm. So what's your next move?
Well, what I've done is I've written a letter to Cardinal Ratzinger, in essence the Vatican. And as you know, we mentioned earlier, church doctrine states that in keeping with the traditions of the Last Supper, there must be some wheat in the host for it to be the valid body of Christ. And the question I pose to the Vatican is, how does the consumption of a rice-based host versus a wheat-based host corrupt those traditions? I never knew the divinity of the Eucharist to lay in wheat.
All right, Elizabeth. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Pelley Waldman joined us from Brielle, New Jersey. You're listening to Here and Now. The story of Haley Waldman and the trouble over her First Communion got us thinking about the nature of communion. So we turn now to David O'Brien, who's a professor of Roman Catholic Studies at Holy Cross University in Worcester, Massachusetts. Welcome, Professor.
Hi.
What is happening when a Catholic receives communion?
When a Catholic receives communion, they are participating in the most central rite or ritual or liturgy of the Catholic Church. And the sacrament of the Eucharist is the most rich experience we have of the Church's deepest teaching about our relationship with one another and with God. So everything that we do in the Church, our community with one another, our sense of responsibility for and with the people of the world, is all summed up in the Eucharistic celebration.
How does wheat figure into this?
Well, traditionally in the teaching of the Church, we try to replicate the experience of the Last Supper, and the Church has always taught that the Eucharistic celebration should have bread that resembles that was used at the time of Christ and therefore would contain wheat. And I think people will tell you that when they were dealing with cases of allergies or illness, they would use a host that would contain a very, very, very minimal amount of wheat. And doctors will tell you that in some cases, even that little amount can be harmful. The other thing that should be mentioned, of course, is that one fully receives the Eucharist when one receives the blood of Christ. So one could experience First Communion or communion at any time only receiving the cup. And it's a surprise to me that wasn't used as a pastoral resolution of this question.
Let's ask just a little deeper question about this original experience. The Last Supper was when Jesus held bread and wine and said, "This is my body, this is my blood," and then instituted the sacrament at that time.
And said to do this in memory of me. And the Catholics, along with some of the other churches, have held very firm to a rich and deep understanding of the Eucharist as not just a symbolic kind of event, but an actual repeating of that experience of the intimate sharing of Christ's very life with his people. So the "do this in memory of me" is probably the most central command that we remember in the life of the Church.
It is interesting that Jesus used something that was neither divine nor human to invest his Church. And so the question, couldn't one use another substance, like rice, to reenact this same experience?
I'm sure this has been discussed in the past and is probably under discussion today. All of us had experiences in recent years of a kind of relaxing of the rite, so that we would have Eucharist in our home and sometimes out in the field outside of church that were more informal and in which bread was consecrated and passed around and crumbs got on the floor. And there are people in the Church who became very nervous about this and worried that the Eucharistic celebration was being trivialized. And so there's been a reemphasis in the last few years on the rules, I guess, that govern these ceremonies. The big point, I think, to say is that this is a pastoral experience, and when we say something is divine or something is sacred, the people are sacred. All people are sacred, and they're made sacred by the life and sacrifice of Christ. We share in that sacredness, and we remember it and make it our own and make it a responsibility by our participation in the Eucharist. And it's tragic that one would let rules stand in the way of that truth and end up with this kind of event, which certainly contributes a lot more to trivializing the Eucharist than did anybody's mass out in the field with struggling people or in living rooms.
Professor O'Brien, thanks very much.
Thank you.
David O'Brien is a professor of Roman Catholic Studies at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Here and Now. Andrew Exum was a soldier. He went to the University of Pennsylvania on an ROTC scholarship and went into the infantry just in time to find himself on the front lines in the war on terrorism. As a commander of a platoon, he was sent to Afghanistan as part of Operation Anaconda. Exum has written about his experiences in a new book, This Man's Army, and Andrew Exum joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me here.
Your book talks about a military tradition in your family, but you also say you wouldn't have been able to afford to go to the University of Pennsylvania without that ROTC scholarship. So question is, would you have joined the Army without the ROTC?
I had a pretty intense desire to serve my country for at least a few years in the military. But certainly, you know, being an ROTC from the years 1996 to 2000, pre-September 11th, very different than the Army I left. You know, I joined my first unit, the 10th Mountain Division, a unit that I write about in this book. And I was excited to go to the 10th Mountain Division because they were getting all the action. And action, you know, in 2000 meant Kosovo, Bosnia. In September 11th, that pretty much changed things. And, you know, my platoon, we were sitting there on September 11th, or September 10th, rather, heartbroken that we were the only battalion not going to Kosovo or Bosnia that winter. We're going to have to sit through this long winter in upstate New York, and then certainly the very next day on September 11th, that changed dramatically for us.
You ended up in the mountains of Afghanistan, and you write a lot about that. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
It's very difficult to fight in that terrain. And for the first few months after September 11th, we were actually guarding a base in Kuwait. And we got into great shape, but that was at sea level. And so then, you know, putting on an 80-pound pack at 11,000 feet, well, that's a lot different. And trying to fight in that terrain, trying to really search out, you know, these Al-Qaeda remnants. We could go from, you know, walking around for 3 days and not seeing anything, and then bam, on the fourth day, you find yourself in a firefight. And that makes it very difficult to, you know, keep soldiers' mental edge up, you know, to keep them always mentally alert, especially when they go for 3 days and don't see anything. Because, you know, on that next day, you could run into some trouble. You could hit into an ambush. You know, nothing can really prepare you for you know, the act of really closing with and engaging the enemy and you know, killing soldiers.
Well, you did, and you killed a soldier.
Right. Yeah, and that was – nothing can psychologically prepare you for really, you know, ending someone else's life in a combat zone. And I think that, you know, especially the first time you ever see, you know, your first dead body or, your, you know, the first person you've felled on the field of battle, so to speak, it's a shock. And I'm not shy about admitting that it was certainly something that you know, almost seems outside of my body. It was surreal. It didn't really even fit into, you know, my previous conception of the world.
Has it had much impact on you since?
Yes, I mean, I think so. I will say, though, that I've been blessed to, I haven't had any post-traumatic stress syndrome from either my two trips to Afghanistan or Iraq, and I think I'm lucky in that respect. But also, you know, ultimately, at the end of the day, you realize, especially in the engagements that I was in, that they were trying to kill you just as much as you were trying to kill them. So it wasn't, it's not the type of thing that you really feel guilty about, because when you come back home and you've got all your guys alive and you've brought them back to their families, you know, at the end of a deployment to combat, you know, you sleep pretty well.
You know, I don't know if you're aware of this, but your training has changed an awful lot from the training that the soldiers in World War II got.
Certainly, yeah.
And in one very important respect, they found during World War II that only about 15% of the guys were actually firing their rifles.
Yeah,
and
that
they
was,
said,
that
we
got
to stop teaching these guys how to shoot, teach them how to kill.
Right. That was a report that was done by a historian, SLA Marshall, in the aftermath of World War II. And it was kind of a shock to people that, you know, it wasn't that these guys were cowards. They were willing to do brave things. They'd carry ammunition to their buddies. They'd carry, you know, wounded off the battlefield. It wasn't that. It's just the, you know, teaching soldiers to kill another human being. It's something that, like I said, it's surreal. It doesn't fit into what we, you know, what we normally imagine growing up in, you know, a place like East Tennessee or you know, Boston or Wichita, Kansas. So, you know, afterwards, the Army made some changes, and certainly, you know, now instead of shooting at just round targets, we shoot at E-type silhouettes, we call them, that look like, you know, a human body, and it's gruesome to listen to it. You know, to, I imagine for listeners, you know, it sounds very macabre, but unfortunately, that's one of the realities. You know, if you talk about the job of the soldier is to fight and kill the enemy, then that's exactly what's necessary.
Well, and you also sort of add to, you quote Clint Eastwood in The Unforgiven, but say he left something out.
Yeah, you know, he says, when you kill a man, you take away everything that he's ever going to be and everything he ever was. But it also takes away something in yourself. And I truly believe that you know, when you're asked to take a life, even if you understand that part and parcel of what you're supposed to do as a soldier, and you understand that it's to preserve your own life and the life of your comrades, it still takes something away from you.
You say that you, in order to go into battle, you try to shut out your faith.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I grew up in a very... you know, obviously in a very religious section of the country and, you know, deep in the Bible Belt. And I've always had a tough time reconciling, you know, my faith with the things I've had to do in combat. And I describe in the book about how I'd say a prayer before every mission and just tell God that I was just kind of going to take a break for a while so I could go do what I needed to do. And then when I came back, but that's just my experience. I think for a lot of soldiers, you know, religion, their faith, it's a tremendous balm in times of stress, especially combat. Just for me, I've always had a tough time reconciling my personal faith, my personal, you know, Christianity with the things I had to do as a soldier.
Do you think about that now?
Yeah, I certainly do. I think now, you know, I was lucky enough to have lived through my combat experiences. It was a great privilege to have led those men in combat, but now, you know, I've got the rest of my life to do some good, I guess.
You took the risks, you endured the hardships, and you come back to this country now, and there's this debate. I mean, when you hear peace activists who haven't served talk about, you know, not going to war, and you hear those who suggest we should be at war who may not have served, or do we know enough about what it's like to serve to be even conducting this sort of debate?
Well, I think, you know, I think you've hit on a good point. I think that you know, ultimately you don't have to have served as a soldier to make decisions about, you know, or to make decisions about whether going to war is right or wrong. You know, FDR never served in the military. So yeah, I don't think it makes that much of a difference. On the other hand, you know, you raise an interesting point in that very few people in our modern society and in America really understand what it's like to be in combat and really have a good grasp of combat. I think that we've seen a lot of romanticizing of combat over the past 10 years, and, you know, in certain films, and, you know, talking about the Greatest Generation. You know, were they great because they went to war? I think that's ridiculous. And I think it's important that, you know, if you're going to talk about war, you know, I think you should defer to the men that have actually, the men and women who have actually been there, because, and that's why, you know, I believe that first-person narratives like my book and like the many others that are going to follow it coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan are important.
Should we reinstate the draft?
No. I think that overall the volunteer military is much better than, and I can't imagine trying to lead conscripts in combat like so many of Vietnam veterans had to. On the other hand, there's no question that the United States military is under a tremendous amount of strain. And when you look at, you know, the utilization of the Army stop-loss policy as well as the activation of the individual ready reserve, that to me is a pretty clear indicator that the military is not prepared from a personnel perspective to really be facing these two long-term commitments in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's unfortunate. I'm not sure there are any easy answers. I think that that both sides are correct when they call to just increase the size of the volunteer military, but that's not something you can do quickly. Ultimately, I'm not sure if a draft would help or harm. I think ultimately it'd probably be more harmful. It's not a long-term solution. The long-term solution is just a robust professional military, I believe.
Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Andrew Exum is the author of This Man's Army, a soldier's story from the front lines of the war on terrorism. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Frank Stachow. Get into your radio and join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.